Hello and welcome to Homestead Hens and Honey, a beekeeping, chicken keeping, and general homesteading podcast. I'm your host, Gemma, and today I'm doing a farm story, which is just sort of a shorter, kind of interesting or fun episode. And this one is about frogs that freeze. Before I get into the main topic about these incredible little amphibians who can freeze themselves and then come back to life, I thought I'd do a couple of quick updates just to kind of give you the rundown of what's been going on here. I know last episode I said I would do a series on all of my new plants, but as you can see, that hasn't happened. I think I overestimated my ability to focus. So I am generally doing better than before when I was kind of going through my depressive episode, but there are just days where everything feels so difficult to get done. But those are fewer and I'm doing the best that I can. So I would say trending upwards. Some actual good news really was that I got a notice that my nucleus colony of Saskatraz hybrid bees were ready for pickup. So I went out there on Tuesday morning, nice and early, and I picked up a very heavy nucleus colony and I brought it home and I got them all settled into one of my 10 frame Langstroth hives. I've worked with Saskatraz bees before. I do like them, even though it was the Saskatraz genetics that absconded for me very early spring. I'm going to risk it because I do generally like them. And I really think that those colonies absconding was a combination of mite levels and the work that was being done on the house. Really, well, not really close, but quite close to where my apiary is. Although speaking of, the lot right behind our house just sold and I'm dreading them putting a house on there. We are losing so much privacy. I do have a lot of trees back there, but obviously once they lose their leaves, you can just see right into their property. There's already a house back there and then this one will make it even busier. So not great, but can't go back in time and make my neighbor not sell his land. So but back to bees. While I was out there after doing the installation, I checked on my other colonies. The one that was there first when I picked up my package, that's the one with the new Carniolan queen. They're doing really, really well. Right now, I've got two deeps and two mediums on for them. They got through their Formic Pro treatment. Great. So I'll probably be doing an oxalic acid treatment next month. My other colonies, which have not been treated yet, I will kind of decide based on weather and time and things like that, whether I want to do a Formic Pro treatment for them or the oxalic acid. But otherwise, everything's looking good. The last nucleus colony that I set up, the one with like Ohio mutt bees or survivor bees, they're building pretty fast. They're looking good. You know, eggs, brood, queen, everything's active in there, and I'm pleased with how things are going. And I did finally get around to putting the robbing screens back on. So all three hives have a robbing screen now. I just find that keeping it on during the active parts of the year is really the best response to the fact that we've consistently had issues with robbing behavior. I also started letting my chickens out to roam, even though we don't have additional fencing up yet. It's just taking so much time for us to decide on what materials we like and kind of what price range we are comfortable with, and then trying to figure out ordering, delivery, and then when we both have time to do the work, because it's definitely not something I'm going to be able to do by myself. And with my husband traveling so much on top of an already busy work schedule, it's just not going to happen within the next couple of weeks. And I noticed that my main flock of chickens was getting kind of touchy. They were a little more irritable with each other. And then they started making a break for it. They kept on trying to rush past me at the door. They obviously just really wanted to get out. And I decided that I would risk it. So I let them out, and I even on a whim, not long afterwards, let out my special needs coop of the two bantams and Mama Petal, my white frizzle. And I wanted to see what would happen. And they ended up joining the flock, like, really easily, honestly. Like, there definitely were some struggles for dominance, you know, who was going to be top hen and so on. Totally normal behavior in chickens. But within probably 2 days, they were completely accepted by the main flock. They followed the flock in that very first night to the coop. And now they just seem to have integrated. Interestingly, the silky chicken didn't really seem to hit anyone's radar as a challenger. So she just kind of seamlessly joined the main flock with almost no issues. Whereas the sex-linked Easter egger, who's like the blue bantam with the big showy comb, she definitely tried to throw her weight around and then found out that she weighs like a quarter of what an English Orpington does. And so she's a little nervous around the other chickens still, but seems to have accepted the fact that she's never going to be queen bee. So right now, this basically means that I have only two of my three coops in use. I have the main flock with Mama Petal and the bantams in the big coop and run, and then Dahlia and her chick that she's raising in the quarantine coop. So my special needs coop is currently empty. Hooray! And I will say that since I know it's a risk to let them out without fencing, because we have had intermittent issues with people's dogs roaming, I have a couple of rules, which is basically that I only really let them out to roam when I'm home, so that if I hear an alarm call, I can get out there as quickly as possible. And I've also left all the grass and the weeds along the back and the sides of the property really long. I'm just not going to mow it. And it acts as good cover for them. And I actually love to watch them move through it, because it's like that scene in Jurassic Park with the velociraptors moving through the grass. And then you just see the grass rippling. And then every now and then that little dinosaur head will pop up and look around. And it's just like that, but with chickens. So I love to just sit and watch them. And speaking of velociraptors, that's what I've been calling the chicks that I've been raising in the house, my little velociraptor babies, because they're so big and kind of awkward now, and they just look like little dinosaurs. I did try and introduce them to Dahlia probably 2 weeks ago when they were still sort of fluffy-ish and babyish, but she wasn't having it. She knew they weren't hers, and she was being very defensive of her chick, and so I just brought them back in again. I took them out yesterday, actually, put them in the run with her, and this was better. So now that they're bigger, she isn't defending her baby from them, so they can interact freely in the run. There's no issue there. However, I found out as we were getting close to dark that she won't let them in the coop, that she gets very defensive if they try and go in there with her and her chick. So I have them inside, and my plan is just to let them out into the run to interact with her and the chick during the day when days are warm enough, and then bring them in at night. They're in today because it's kind of coolish and we're expecting some rain, and I think it's just better for them to stay where I can guarantee that they're warm and dry. The good news there, though, is that Dahlia has started laying eggs again as of yesterday, and that means that soon the broody mama phase is going to be completely gone, and she'll start treating even her own chick less like her baby and more like just a fellow flock member. When she raised the chicks before, I remember how distressed they were that suddenly Mama Dahlia was being so mean to them. And it's just her way of making sure that she's still in charge. And when that happens, I actually think I'll have a better chance of integrating the velociraptors, because she will just see them as challenging flock members. She'll tell them off once. They will not fight back, I can guarantee it. And they'll probably befriend her chick, who is going to start feeling abandoned. And so I think it will be easier for them to kind of unite as a flock at that point. And then I'll just let them get big enough until I feel comfortable trying to introduce them as a group to the main flock. So let's see what else. Oh, okay. So I'm pleased to say that my stray kitty friend, who I've named her Topaz because of her bright yellow eyes, she's actually been doing really, really well with the chickens. So that was one of my concerns. Was she going to start hunting the chickens? Would she hurt them? Would she get into their coop and cause trouble? I didn't know what would happen. She actually is very wary of them, which makes sense because the vast majority of them are actually bigger than she is, and the rooster definitely outweighs her. She seems to kind of recognize that they're not prey, and that this makes me sound like I'm anthropomorphizing her, which maybe I am, but I feel like she recognizes that they're important to me or that they're somehow connected to me. So she doesn't mess with them in any way. She doesn't try and stalk them. She doesn't even really watch them that much. She really tries to keep herself separate from them. Even the little bantams, who I were most worried about around her because she probably could take them if she wanted to, she is very much like, no, chickens are to be avoided and that's mama's business. And that's perfect for me. I hope that continues. And I kind of hope as well that if another cat tried to cause problems, that she might get in there and scare her off, because she's very territorial now of what she considers her area. She's also 100% my cat now. There's no getting around it. She is super affectionate. She will let me pet her away from the food area now. That was the big step that we had yet to cross, where she only wanted pets by the food bowls. Even if there was no food there, she would not let me touch her anywhere else on the property. But now she follows me, she loves to be pet, she purrs all the time, she rubs up against me. I've recently started picking her up briefly to get her used to it, and I'll be honest, I've had days where I kind of regret befriending her because she's very vocal, and there are days where she just wants me to be out there to pet her, but I'm busy and she will follow me around the property just meow, 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 meow the whole time. I mean, I think one time she went for an hour that I was out there and I was just trying to tune her out with music or whatever. And it's just because she wants attention. She had food, she had water. She just wanted me to pet her. And it does drive me a little bit up the wall. However, she is earning her keep. So I was kind of worrying at one point that she was losing her wildness and would maybe stop hunting and just rely on me for food. And then one day I went there sort of late afternoon and her little head popped up from under the grass and she had a chipmunk in her mouth. So I was like, okay, she is still hunting. This is good. Well, on top of that, she started leaving the heads of the rodents that she catches out on the path for me to find. And I think it's like that cat thing of, here, I brought you a gift. And even more than the fact that she's keeping the rodents under control, is she's actually killed two moles for me. And interestingly, she doesn't eat the moles. She doesn't even nibble them. I don't know if they taste bad to cats or something, but she just kills them for me and she puts them really prominently in the middle of the path so that I will see them. Now, I love moles. They're really cool little critters. They're very soft. I mean, there's just so much about them that I think is really neat. But I appreciate her keeping their population down, because if they get into my vegetable gardens, they are going to just destroy them. And I've already noticed that we had mole sort of hills or tunnels popping up in the front lawn, and now they've been seen around the side. So her hunting the moles to me is a win-win. And speaking of like garden critters, I think it's slugs that have been eating my poor little cucumber plant that's trying so desperately to grow for me. So I need to look into natural or like bee friendly methods of slug control. You know, I don't want to put a ton of pesticides out. And I thought that crushed eggshells could help, because this seems to be a long-standing garden myth that I've heard about for years. But when I looked into it, I found a really good article that tested the theory and found that eggshells do not repel slugs. I'll drop a link to that article in the episode description. I also found that some of my sunflowers that I put in kind of a small bed up against the fence, just to kind of fill it in a little bit, it's where my borage is and where one of the big common burdock plants has kind of planted itself. I noticed that some of my little sunflowers have had all the tops eaten off them. They weren't very tall, maybe like 2 foot at that point. They weren't even budding. I suspect it's deer and I'm very annoyed. On the plus side, the main sunflower bed that I have on the far side, right up against the entire fence line there, the deer never seem to go that way. I don't know if it's because it's too close to my house and my neighbor's house and it makes them feel boxed in. But so far, those sunflowers, touch wood, are still untouched. So fingers crossed, I'll still get to see at least some sunflowers in the coming months. And one sort of final homesteady update before I get to the main topic is that on June 20th, we celebrated my greyhound Kaylee's 11th birthday. And so I just wanted to say happy birthday to Kaylee. We love her so much. We adopted her originally as a heart healer when we lost our first greyhound, Peyton. And she has not been a disappointment. I mean, it was instant love the minute we saw her. And even though she is high maintenance in some ways, you know, she has that kind of unusual tooth issue. She's allergic to poultry. She gets these like painful corns in the pads of her front feet. And she has anxiety, which at one point she actually needed treatment for, like medication. But it doesn't matter how neurotic or silly she is. She's just so loving. She's so gentle. She adores my husband more than anyone in the world, and I love seeing them interact together. It's just so charming. And I don't know, I love her so much, so I wanted to talk about her here. She's a really patient pack leader, despite the fact that she's a scaredy cat of human-y things like, you know, slippery floors and new places. She is always in charge when it comes to any of our dogs. She rules our little pack. When we have foster dogs, she kind of takes charge of them. She's so gentle. She's so supportive. She really seems to know what other dogs need from her. And one of my favorite memories of this sort of behavior is when we fostered Willie the Whippet, and he was snapping and snarling at my dogs because he was so overwhelmed by, you know, being surrendered and losing the only home he'd ever known. And so I had him in a big crate where he could just decompress, see the other dogs, but he didn't have to interact with them. And Kaylee just goes up to the crate and she lies down with her back pressed against the crate. And she just stayed with him the whole time that he was in the crate. She always made sure she was right there next to him, just kind of existing. But to me, it really seemed like she was saying, you know, hey, buddy, I'm right here. You're okay. Everything's okay. We can just nap here next to each other. It's not a big deal. And she did stick kind of close to him for the first couple of days, but he integrated so quickly after that. And I think a big part of why he adjusted was because of Kaylee. So I hope you'll all join me in celebrating her birthday, even though we're a couple of days on now, by sharing in our little tradition, which is that every pup gets a little bit of whipped cream on a puppy birthday. So my pups have had this. We also had some whipped cream, and I hope you'll consider sharing some whipped cream with your canines at home. Okay, so let's talk about the main topic. What am I talking about? There's a frog that freezes. Is that a real thing? Yes. And actually, I'm kind of wondering how many of you have already know about this, because it turns out that this interesting little frog, which is new to me as a British person living in the US, is actually one of the most common frog species throughout North America. It has a huge distribution across all of North America. And you have likely heard it calling even before the spring's peepers in very early spring. The frog that I'm talking about is the wood frog. And interestingly, it has two Latin names. I don't know if this is one of those scientific disagreements, but you'll see the wood frog listed as Lithobate sylvaticus or Rana sylvatica. And this small, unassuming little frog is only about 2 to 3 inches in length, with pink, tan, or dark brown skin, and a prominent dark mask that runs from just underneath the jaw to behind the ear. They tend to have white or pale yellow bellies with occasional dark mottling, and their toes are not fully webbed. Males can be identified by their swollen thumbs, which they use, they hook their thumbs together after wrapping their arms around a female during mating. The wood frog's call is actually pretty easy to detect. I have a hard time remembering, you know, which amphibian makes which noise, but this is one of the few that I remember pretty easily because it's a series of short staccato noises that sound like a raspy quack from a duck. Now, another interesting fact about the wood frog is that it is the only North American frog found north of the Arctic Circle, so it's already quite extraordinary. In terms of habitat, in eastern areas, you'll find them in moist woodlands, in western areas, open grasslands, and in tundra for the far north areas of their distribution. And they actually breed in early spring before the ice has completely melted. And they breed in ephemeral pools, also known as vernal pools, as opposed to a permanent water source like a lake. Eggs are attached en masse to submerged vegetation, and it's actually very common for females to lay their eggs close to other egg masses, so you'll often find an area just brimming with their spawn. Like all frogs, the eggs will first develop into tadpoles before metamorphosizing into frogs. Following this transition, less than 20% of the juveniles will move away from their birthing site, so the majority stays close and they return to their natal pool when it's time to breed. The lifespan of a wild wood frog is usually less than 3 years, and they often breed just once in their lifetime, although there have been cases of them breeding 2 to 3 times. Now, the good news is that the wood frog is not listed as endangered or threatened. The bad news is that their preferred breeding grounds are. These ephemeral wetlands are decreasing steadily due to human encroachment. And this is one of the reasons that wood frogs have become a little bit more interesting to researchers of these areas, because they're often considered obligate breeders of such areas. And so getting to study them, studying the effects of these decreasing numbers of ephemeral pools could be a useful way for them to track how quickly these pools are declining, how it's affecting the local ecosystem and things of that manner. Okay, so you're probably thinking, okay, that's very interesting, Gemma, but what about this freezing thing? Wood frogs will freeze during winter. And apparently, they're not the only frogs who do this. The big question here is, how on earth is that possible? If you are into science fiction, or you're just one of those weirdos like me who looks into things like cryogenic freezing because it sounds bonkers and you can't help but look into it, you'll know that the main problem about mammals or any animal freezing is that the ice crystals that form inside our cells puncture the cells, rupturing them and leading to fatality. Well, with wood frogs, things are a little different. So the first thing you should know is that they hibernate under the leaf litter or just a couple of inches under soil. So they're very exposed to outside temperatures. Now, perhaps because of this, they've developed an interesting ability to survive freezing without injury. And what I'm going to do here is I'm just going to quote Wikipedia because they have the most concise summary and explanation of it. And I didn't want to just try and write all this out because it's just the perfect descriptor. So to quote the Wikipedia article on wood frogs, urea is accumulated in tissues in preparation for overwintering, and liver glycogen is converted in large quantities to glucose in response to internal ice formation. both urea and glucose act as chiroprotectants to limit the amount of ice that forms and to reduce osmotic shrinking of cells. Frogs found in southern Canada and the American Midwest can tolerate freezing temperatures of -3 to -6 degrees Celsius, 27 to 21 degrees Fahrenheit. The wood frogs have evolved various physiological adaptations that allow them to tolerate the freezing of 65 to 70% of total body water. When water freezes, ice crystals form in cells and break up the structure so that when the ice thaws, the cells are damaged. Frozen frogs also need to endure the interruption of oxygen delivery to their tissues, as well as strong dehydration and shrinkage of their cells when water is drawn out of cells to freeze. So I think that's pretty straightforward, but just to summarize, what it's saying is that the use of accumulating urea and glucose is essential to this process of preventing damage to cells that have frozen and then thawed. And that the frogs can survive this as long as the total percentage of the water within their body, so that includes their blood and lymphatic fluids and all of that, is 65 to 70%. So they're not 100% rock solid frozen all the way to. You can't pick them up, tap them up against some other ice and feel, you know, the bonk, 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 it's just completely solid. No, it's 65 to 70% of their body. And the really cool thing that I saw as well in this article is that the frogs that are found further north, so especially the ones up in the Arctic region, have more glucose detected in their body. So clearly glucose is a very important component of this process to prevent destruction of cells. And amazingly, as the article said, they can tolerate freezing temperatures of -3 to -6 degrees Celsius, which is 27 to 21 degrees Fahrenheit. And incredibly, there's a frog that can endure even colder temperatures. And that's the Japanese tree frog. So this tree frog has been observed surviving in temperatures as low as minus 31 degrees Fahrenheit, which is minus 35 degrees Celsius. And they can survive at these temperatures for up to 120 days. That is mind-blowing. And so there you have it. There is our little frog, the humble little wood frog. You've probably stumbled upon them when you're gardening. You've likely heard them calling, either before or with spring peepers. This is a frog that I think is very familiar to many of us who live in North America. And yet, how many of us knew that they had these absolutely incredible traits to survive frozen weather? And how many people knew how important they're proving to be as we study the decrease in ephemeral wetlands? I hope that you found this little bitty episode on wood frogs interesting. I personally find them fascinating. They're one of my favorite frogs to find. I can identify the call, as I said earlier, but also when I've been clearing out the drainage area to encourage water flow, that's often where I will find them. And we kind of have an ephemeral water area with the little swampland at the back because it only has water in it during parts of the year. I'm not sure if it is technically a vernal pool. There's some very distinctive features that go into categorizing that, but I will say that it is filled with wood frogs and spring peepers, and I absolutely adore them, and they're just very, very cool little critters that I'm happy to share with you. Hopefully, by next week, I will at least have part of my plant information available. I am just having issues with focusing right now, but it's something that I do honestly care about. I really love to just, you know, go through books with information on all the plants and the beautiful photography. It's very soothing. And then to get to see them as they're developing this spring in my own garden is incredible. So I'll be back in a week, hopefully with plant information for you. And until then, I hope you are happy and healthy and getting outside and enjoying the gardens. Although for any Australian listeners, I hope you are staying warm and staying cozy. And as always, hug your hens and then wash your hands. Thank you so much for listening. I'll be back soon. Bye-bye.